I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. Is Democracy Now!
I ask you to have mercy, Mr. President, on those in our communities whose children fear that their parents will be taken away, and that you help those who are fleeing war zones and persecution in their own lands to find compassion and welcome here.
Episcopal Bishop Marian Edgar Buddy directly challenges President Trump in her sermon at the National Prayer Service Tuesday. We'll hear her remarks and look at why Public Citizen and other groups are suing DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, which is headed by the world's richest man, Elon Musk. We'll also look at the connection between Musk's rise to power and the Supreme Court's decision in Citizen United.
It's largely a function of Musk having poured over $250 million into super PACs last election cycle. And that spending is only possible because of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, which turned 15 this week.
Finally, Ravi Ragbir is back. President Biden granted the immigrant rights leader a pardon a day before he left office.
This has meant a lot for my family and myself because it stops the continued punishment that I've faced throughout the last 2 decades, where I every day was uncertain because I faced the possibility of deportation.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's purged several career officials from key positions at the Justice Department, a move critics say will pave the way to weaponize the agency against Trump's enemies. The Washington Post reports at least 15 experienced career staffers across the Justice Department's National Security and Criminal Divisions were removed from their positions and reassigned, among them a senior counterintelligence attorney who played a key role in deciding to search Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence to retrieve classified documents. He's reportedly been transferred to a newly created Office of Sanctuary Cities Enforcement. The purge has come as Trump asserted broad presidential authority in his first full day in office, firing the heads of the Transportation Security Administration and the Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, Admiral Linda Fagan, who in 2022 became the first woman to lead a branch of the U.S. Armed Forces. She was fired as the White House ordered employees in any federal diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility, or DEI offices to be placed on administrative leave effective immediately. A coalition of 22 Democratic-led states on Tuesday filed a lawsuit in federal court to block President Trump's executive order attempting to end birthright citizenship. The District of Columbia and the City of San Francisco are also plaintiffs in the suit, which followed a similar lawsuit filed by the ACLU. This marks the beginning of what's expected to be mounting litigation against Trump's anti-immigrant agenda. California Attorney General Rob Bonta said Tuesday the order clearly violates the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment.
It also violates the Immigration and Nationality Act and flouts more than 125 years, a century and a quarter, of long-standing, well-established precedent set by the U.S. Supreme Court. The president has overstepped his authority by a mile, and we will hold him accountable.
In related news, the Trump administration will allow federal immigration agents to conduct raids at schools, hospitals, and houses of worship, ending a years-long policy that banned ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, from arresting people at these sites. This all comes as Reuters reports nearly 1,600 Afghan refugees who've been cleared for resettlement in the U.S. have been left in immigration limbo after the Trump administration suspended refugee admissions. Among them are unaccompanied Afghan children hoping to reunite with their families in the U.S., and Afghans who aided the U.S. occupation and now fear they'll be killed or punished by the Taliban government. In the occupied West Bank, at least 10 Palestinians were killed and dozens more injured Tuesday when Israeli forces, backed by helicopter gunships, launched a major offensive on the city of Jenin. Eyewitnesses described seeing bodies in the streets with ambulances blocked from retrieving the dead and wounded. An estimated 2,000 Palestinian families have been displaced by the fighting. This comes after the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem documented more Israeli settler attacks on Palestinian villages across the occupied West Bank carried out with the full cooperation of Israeli soldiers. Videos shared by B'Tselem appears to show settlers throwing stones and Molotov cocktails at Palestinians in Sinjil, where 6 Palestinians were injured over the weekend. In another incident, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a 15-year-old Palestinian boy as they escorted rioting settlers through the West Bank town of Sabastia. B'Tselem says the settler attacks are meant to impose a price tag for the Gaza ceasefire deal. On Monday, Palestinian families erupted in celebration as Israel released the first wave of captives from Israeli jails as part of the Gaza ceasefire deal. Of the first 90 Palestinians released, 69 are women, 21 children. Most have been detained without charge under Israel's administrative detention law. Among them is the journalist Rula Hassanein, an editor for the Ramallah-based Watan Media Network. She reunited with her infant daughter, whom she last saw 10 months ago when the baby was just 9 months old. She was tried by a military court at Israel's notorious Ofer prison and convicted of incitement after she shared social media posts sympathetic to Palestinians in Gaza. Speaking after her release, Hassanein told the news site Middle East Eye she and other Palestinian women were deprived of food, clothing, and medical care.
There were numerous violations against female prisoners as women. Honestly, it's difficult to even describe them on air or even in private conversations. There was significant infringement of basic rights. Headscarves were removed, strip searches were conducted repeatedly, and there were sudden night inspections. There was repression beyond imagination, a purely oppressive situation.
In Gaza, Israeli forces shot and killed a 12-year-old Palestinian child in the southern city of Rafah on Monday in what witnesses called a blatant violation of the ceasefire deal. Video of the assault shows Israeli forces opening fire on another person attempting to retrieve the boy's limp body. The UN's Humanitarian Affairs Office says more than 2,400 aid trucks have entered the besieged Palestinian territory since Israel lifted its blockade Sunday when the ceasefire deal took effect. In Israel, a man with a knife stabbed and wounded 4 people on a Tel Aviv street Tuesday evening before he was shot dead by a civilian at the scene in an attack police are investigating as politically motivated violence. Haaretz reports the attacker was a 29-year-old Moroccan citizen with a U.S. residency card who arrived in Israel 3 days ago. It was the second stabbing in Tel Aviv in just 4 days. In related news, Israel's military chief of staff has resigned over what he said was his failure to prevent the October 7, 2023 attack. Lieutenant General Hatzi Halevi becomes the most senior Israeli figure to resign over failures to prevent Hamas's surprise attack on that day. Halevi led Israel's military campaign that reduced much of Gaza's civilian infrastructure to rubble and massacred over 47,000 people, according to Palestinian officials who believe another at least 10,000 bodies are trapped beneath the rubble. He's expected to resign fully in March. President Trump's choice to become the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations refused to say Tuesday whether the Palestinian people have the right to self-determination. New York Republican Congressmember Elise Stefanik made the comments during her confirmation hearing at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where she confirmed to Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen that she believes Israel has a biblical right of dominion over the occupied West Bank.
I'm rarely surprised by answers in my office, but I did ask you whether you subscribe to the views of Finance Minister Smotrich.
Smotrich,
this is the Israeli Finance Minister Smotrich, and the former National Security Minister Ben-Gvir, who believe that Israel has a biblical right to the entire West Bank. And in that conversation, you told me that, yes, you shared that view. Is that your view today?
Yes.
In more news on Israel, the tech giant Google provided the Israeli military with access to its latest artificial intelligence technology since nearly the beginning of its assault on Gaza. That's according to The Washington Post, which obtained internal documents showing Google directly assisted Israeli military forces despite the company's efforts to publicly distance itself from Israel's national security apparatus. Last year, Google fired dozens of employees with the group No Tech for Apartheid after they demanded Google withdraw from Project Nimbus, a $1.2 billion contract to provide cloud computing services to the Israeli military. Panama's issued a letter to the UN Security Council expressing alarm over President Trump's threats to invade and retake the Panama Canal. This is Panama's president, Jose Raul Molino.
The day I traveled here, I stated my government's position in a statement, rejecting in its entirety everything Mr. Trump said. Firstly, because it was false, and secondly, because the Panama Canal belongs to Panama and will continue to belong to Panama. The Panama Canal was not a concession or a gift from the United States. The Panama Canal came into being in 1914, following a bilateral treaty in 1903 at the dawn of our independence with Colombia.
President Trump's defense secretary nominee, Pete Hegseth, is facing fresh claims of violent and threatening behavior and problems with alcohol abuse. Hegseth's former sister-in-law, Danielle Hegseth, who was married to his brother, said in a sworn affidavit to Senate lawmakers that Hegseth made his second wife, Samantha Hegseth, fear for her safety. The affidavit alleged Samantha Hegseth once had to hide from Pete Hegseth in a closet and that she gave her friends a code word in case she needed help and developed an escape plan. Danielle Hegseth also said she witnessed Pete Hegseth repeatedly scream, "No means yes," at a bar in 2013, suggesting men don't need to obtain sexual consent from women. The affidavit was submitted in response to requests from Democratic Senator Jack Reed, who said the background check process for Hegseth, quote, has been inadequate, and this sworn affidavit confirms that fact, he said. Both Pete and Samantha Hegseth have denied these allegations. Leaders of the far-right groups, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, were freed from prison Tuesday after President Trump granted full, complete, and unconditional presidential pardons to over 1,500 people involved in the January 6th insurrection. Among those released was Enrique Tarrio, the former leader of the Proud Boys, who'd been serving a 22-year federal prison sentence after he was convicted of seditious conspiracy. Also released Tuesday, former Oath Keepers leader Stuart Rhodes, who spoke to reporters after his 18-year prison sentence was commuted by Trump.
I feel vindicated and validated. Yes, absolutely. Of course, I haven't gotten a pardon yet. I got commutation. But I'm applying for one. I'm pretty positive I'll get one. When they review my case, they'll understand that I was targeted for who I am, not for anything I did.
Capitol rioter Jacob Chansley, whose horned fur hat, face paint, and six-foot spear made him one of the more recognizable insurrectionists on January 6th, known as the QAnon Shaman, wrote on the social media site X, quote, "Thank you, President Trump. Now I'm going to buy some mother F bleep guns," unquote. Chansley was among a group that broke into the Senate chamber and left a threatening note to then Vice President Mike Pence reading, "It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming," unquote. Most Republican leaders have remained quiet on Trump's pardons. Asked whether he supported or opposed the pardon, Senate Majority Leader John Thune said, quote, "We're not looking backwards, we're looking forward," unquote. Capitol Police officers, many of whom were wounded by the mob Trump incited on January 6th, blasted Trump's pardons and commutations. Former Sergeant Aquilino Gunnell called it a, quote, "miscarriage of justice, a betrayal, a mockery, and a desecration of the men and women that risk their lives defending our democracy," he said. And in labor news, unionized Costco employees have authorized a strike set to begin February 1st unless they reach a deal with the mega retailer before their contract expires at the end of the month. The Teamsters said about 18,000 Costco workers are ready to walk off the job at 56 of the company's warehouse stores across five states. Workers are demanding better wages, paid family leave, sick time, and protections against surveillance. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show looking at growing pushback to Donald Trump's sweeping moves to reshape the country. On Tuesday, 24 states and cities sued to block Trump's executive order to end birthright citizenship. The Trump administration's also facing four lawsuits over the formation of DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, a new department headed by the world's richest man, Elon Musk. In a moment, we'll speak to the co-president of Public Citizen, one of the organizations suing over DOGE. But we begin today's show with the words of Episcopal Bishop Marian Edgar Buddy. On Tuesday, she gave the sermon at the inaugural prayer service at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. She directly confronted President Trump, who was sitting nearby with Vice President J.D. Vance.
Let me make one final plea, Mr. President. Millions have put their trust in you. And as you told the nation yesterday, you have felt the providential hand of a loving God. In the name of our God, I ask you to have mercy upon the people in our country who are scared now. There are gay, lesbian, and transgender children in Democratic, Republican, and independent families. Some who fear for their lives. And the people who pick our crops and clean our office buildings, who labor in poultry farms and meatpacking plants, who wash the dishes after we eat in restaurants and work the night shifts in hospitals, they may not be citizens or have the proper documentation. But the vast majority of immigrants are not criminals. They pay taxes and are good neighbors. They are faithful members of our churches and mosques, synagogues, wadara, and temples. I ask you to have mercy, Mr. President, on those in our communities whose children fear that their parents will be taken away, and that you help those who are fleeing war zones and persecution in their own lands to find compassion and welcome here. Our God teaches us that we are to be merciful to the stranger, for we were all once strangers in this land. May God grant us the strength and courage to honor the dignity of every human being, to speak the truth to one another in love, and walk humbly with each other and our God. For the good of all people, good of all people in this nation and the world.
Episcopal Bishop Marian Edgar Buddy addressing President Trump and his family at the inaugural prayer service at the National Cathedral in Washington, as Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance sat in the front pew. Trump was later asked at the White House about her sermon.
What did you think of the service?
What did you think? Did you like it? Did you find it exciting? Not too exciting, was it? I didn't think it was a good service, no. Thank you very much.
Thank you, press. Thank you, press.
They can do much better.
President Trump later posted a message about Bishop Marian Edgar Buddy on a social media platform, Truth Social, writing, quote, "The so-called bishop who spoke at the National Prayer Service on Tuesday morning was a radical left hardline Trump hater. She brought her church into the world of politics in a very ungracious way. She was nasty in tone and not compelling or smart," unquote. Republican Congressman Mike Collins of Georgia posted a message online saying, quote, "The person giving the sermon should be added to the deportation list," unquote. For the record, Episcopal Bishop Marian Edgar Buddy was born in New Jersey. She served as Bishop of Washington since 2011. Coming up, Public Citizen sues the Trump administration over DOGE, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. Stay with us. Garth Hudson. The multi-instrumentalist of the band died Tuesday at the age of 87. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Trump administration is facing four lawsuits so far over its formation of DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, a new initiative headed by the world's richest man, Elon Musk, who spent over $250 million to help Trump win in November. Trump initially named former Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy to be Musk's co-chair, but Ramaswamy has announced he's leaving the role to run for governor of Ohio. There are reports Musk pushed for Ramaswamy to be ousted from his role. The New York Times reports Musk is likely to be given office space inside the West Wing of the White House, even though DOGE is not an official government department. One of the lawsuits was filed by Public Citizen, along with the American Federation of Government Employees and the State Democracy Defenders Fund. We're joined now by Robert Weissman, co-president of Public Citizen. Rob, if you can start off by just talking about why Public Citizen has joined others in suing over DOGE, and explain even the significance of the word DOGE.
Well, hey, Aman, it's great to be with you. We sued over this new thing, which is really an advisory committee called DOGE. It's not a government department, to force it to comply with the law. Advisory committees have to follow certain procedures under federal law. They have to have balanced representation. They have to have open meetings, have a charter, be subject to open records law, and so on. There's no sign that this DOGE is doing any of those things. The term DOGE refers to a meme coin, a cryptocurrency that Elon Musk is a fan of. So it's a little bit of a joke, but the joke's on all of us. What DOGE is about is empowering Elon Musk, the world's richest human being, to make recommendations and really drive policymaking in the Trump administration to roll back regulations, the rules that give us clean air, clean water, safe food, fair workplaces, and more, to benefit corporations and to drive a libertarian extremist agenda of cutting government spending primarily on programs to help the poor and vulnerable, including nutrition assistance and Medicaid.
And Robert Weissman, the Public Citizen came up with its own cost-cutting report titled DOGE Delusions. Could you talk about what you're recommending in terms of cost-cutting in government?
Yeah, well, of course, first off, efficiency is not a primary value. The first question is what the government ought to be doing. But we said, okay, you're interested in saving money. That's what you mean by efficiency. We'll play that game. What could the government do to be efficient, not just ideologically driven, not just how to drive corporate profits? And we came up with $500 billion in pretty easy savings. $500 billion every year in Washington, that counts for $5 trillion because we count in 10-year increments. We could save $200 billion if we dealt with excessive drug pricing. Some of that would help taxpayers, some of it would help consumers. We could save $100 billion every year or more by ending privatized Medicare, which is a ripoff of the Medicare system. We could easily cut $200 billion from the Defense Department, the Pentagon budget. So altogether, real quick, $500 billion, more money to be saved by cutting subsidies for oil and gas companies, and on and on. Then we said, well, efficiency doesn't just mean saving money. It should mean raising money efficiently as well. And it would be easy to raise an additional $500 billion against the baseline of the current Trump tax cuts by raising taxes on the rich and corporations. So now we're talking about $1 trillion every year. What should we do with that money? Well, efficiency should also mean making smart public investments. The programs that Musk is targeting, food stamps, early education interventions, and the like, those pay back. We should be doing more of those things because even in dollars and cents terms, even if you don't care about real human beings, just in dollar and cents terms, they pay back. And the most important public investment we can make, if we're just worried about dollars and cents, is making deep and profound investments to address the climate crisis, to reduce the harm we're going to face, and to mitigate the damage that is now going to be unavoidable.
And you talk about Musk, who's been tapped to head this advisory committee. What about the built-in conflicts of interest, given all the businesses that Musk has that do that depend on the federal government?
Yeah, they're profound and without parallel. And in fact, I think Musk's role in this government is part of a broader convergence of corporate and government power, corporate and state power, that doesn't really have a parallel in American history, certainly not in the last 100 years. Profoundly dangerous. But when it comes to Musk himself, because he's involved in so many businesses, he has really important interests before huge portions of the government. For example, he wants Twitter, X, to become a payment transmitter. That's like Apple Pay. If it does so, it would be regulated by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Musk has called for the elimination of that bureau. He's called for the elimination of the agency that would regulate his company. He has huge business with the Department of Defense through Starlink. He has huge business at NASA, where he's helped install a buddy to run the agency and is competing with an Amazon-affiliated corporation. He would rather win that competition and have Amazon and Jeff Bezos eliminated from the competition. He is facing significant enforcement actions from the Securities and Exchange Commission. He'll have the ability to influence that. He's got big problems at Tesla with enforcement of auto safety rules against Tesla's self-driving vehicles. And on and on and on. And he's in position now making recommendations throughout the government to advance his own business interests. And of course, there's every reason to assume he's going to do exactly that.
Now, Rob Weissman, you and your co-president, Public Citizen, asked to be on the advisory committee?
Right. So advisory committees are governed by something called the Federal Advisory Committee Act, FACA. And FACA says that advisory committees have to be fair and balanced. Well, when this so-called DOGE was started, it had two members, Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, two billionaires. Our position is, we think not controversially, two billionaires does not make a balanced committee. So we recommended ourselves as experts and advocates for consumers and the public interest to offer some balance. We haven't received a response. But the failure of the committee to provide balance is one of the bases of our lawsuit.
Why, Rob Weissman, do you believe that President Trump issued one of his executive orders against EVs when, of course, you've got Musk, who is the head of Tesla?
Well, I think the core, I mean, there's a few reasons. The primary reason is that part of the Trump agenda is to race towards climate apocalypse, to double down on oil, gas, and even coal development, exploitation, and use, and to move away from the advances we've made in renewable energy. Electric cars, obviously an important shift away from oil and gas and towards electricity powered by the sun and wind. The EV program that Biden adopted and helped push through as part of the Inflation Reduction Act was singularly important in helping drive the move towards electric cars. And it's Trump's agenda to do away with all that. Of course, Musk is in the business of selling electric cars. So there's reason to say, well, does this hurt Musk? According to Musk himself, it might cause him some pain, but will cause his competitors in the business more pain. So at the end of